Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. How much have you had to drink today? A lot of people like to kid themselves they are not problem drinkers. They've got it in hand. They are not overdoing it. You know, a lot of people you know, and possibly you yourself, if you're not careful, might consider a couple of cocktails for lunch. Certainly not too much, just enough to relax, enjoy a good scintillating conversation, and kind of help digest your food. I've talked about the two martinis for lunch bunch, but that really includes many, many millions of Americans, Canadians, Britons, South Africans, Australians, and people all over the world, for that matter. And then, of course, maybe early evening, if you're going out to dinner with friends, you would have one or two before dinner, at least that many. Maybe carry a cocktail glass in to where you're being seated for dinner with you. And then maybe you would order a bottle of wine and share that with a party of four to six people, or maybe two bottles. And then, of course, by the time you get home, all that food on your stomach, watching a late-night TV show or something, you might have one or two to go to bed on. So by the time the day is over, you've had something like 7 to 9 cocktails with about an ounce or two of alcohol, of the pure stuff in there, plus maybe about a fourth or so of a bottle of wine and maybe a couple of cans of beer. And, of course, you're saying to yourself, me, an alcoholic? Nonsense. I don't have to have the stuff. I just enjoy taking a little drink now and then. Well, you know, there are millions upon millions of Americans that have a real problem on the job, in their family, with their boss, in productivity, with their personal health. They're accident prone. There are statistics sometimes that cause insurance premiums to soar. There are also sometimes statistics in automobile accidents representing about 55,000 dead people and hideously disfigured people way beyond those figures every single year. So we, in a three-part series of programs, have begun to discuss the problem of alcoholism, which, believe it or not, represented more arrests in the last year or so in the American crime brackets than did hard drug use. This is the second three-part series on the subject of alcoholism. The last program covered the scope and nature of this disease, as it's being known, with the first-person accounts from several authorities in recovering alcoholics. This time, we want to focus on the case histories of four alcoholics who all shared one thing in common. They were addicted as teenagers. And we'll let each of these four alcoholics unveil their own private story in an interview sequence is conducted by one of our World Tomorrow broadcast reporters. Although each case is unique, you'll discover a number of common warning signs. So listen carefully to what these young people have to say.
I'm Tim, and I'm 17. And I guess what got me involved in the alcoholism is there's like a mystique about it. Like everyone's going, like you see it on TV, the elegant people sipping beer. And there's like a big romantic thing about it, and I looked at it, I saw it in my parents, I saw it on TV, I saw it advertised, and I thought, boy, that's where it's at, you know? I want to get involved and be elegant and get into that. I was never really satisfied with life. I was always looking for something more, something better. And it's like the second I drank, I got away from those feelings, and I felt different and away from all that uptight and looking feeling, and I was just inside me in it, and I didn't have to feel bad. And I didn't like where I was at, and drinking took me to a different spot, which seemed, when I first drank especially, it seemed much better than the spot I was in before I drank. And it was a tricky thing. I didn't know where it was leading me.
You're 17 now. What age was this?
My first drink was about 12, maybe 11. And it was just from my parents and stuff. I got out of their liquor cabinet, or a friend would get it from their parents, or I would steal out of garages, you know, wherever.
From your own personal example, can you give us some idea of just how serious the problem of alcoholism can become?
Oh, sure. Like I said, I started with drinking, and alcoholism is no respecter of chemicals. It means you can be a drug addict as the same type of personality as an alcoholic. And I was taking drugs, acid, and it was making me screwing. I had bad trips, and I gone to hospitals before, you know, because I was having a bad trip, and I kept taking it, and that's like the tricky mind. It's okay if I take it once, but last time I took it was 2 days ago, but I'm taking it again. And it came to the point where I got high and I didn't come down. And when you're high in acid, that means You see, things aren't, you know, it's a total unreality. They call it psychosis, which is just a name, but it means that you're seeing things that aren't there, and you're thinking thoughts, and you're living a total fantasy, and I didn't come out for 2 months, and they thought I'd never come out. They were about to give me shock treatment, and it's very dangerous. I guess a lot of the time I was like a blabbling idiot, and I was, and that's where the using led me. And after I came out of that, I started using again. It was leading me to the same place, and like that's when I had, you know, I got to the point where God, you know, I had to realize something in my tricky mind. Something had to soak through a deep skull, you know, and some people have to go to those lengths. Some people, a lot of people die from it. A lot of people die, or they commit suicide because they feel so helpless, they end up cutting their wrists or something. And the best thing to do is to get early and find out, you know, before you have to go through what I did, because I almost never came back. I could be in a hospital right now in a padded cell, be there the rest of my life. And, you know, that's where this using can lead.
As these problems began to close in, did you realize that it was the alcohol?
I guess deep inside I did, but I shied away from that as much as possible. As it came to a point where when my health was deteriorating, I couldn't attribute to anything but, you know, the dope I was putting in me or the alcohol I was drinking. And it just got to the point where I was realizing I'm not in school because I want to party. And it was a hard realization to face. I stayed away from that as long as I could, but it slowly dawned on me that partying was interfering with my life.
As an individual, how was it that you began to gain the upper hand in this battle against alcoholism?
I guess the first time that I started to get any grip on the situation is when I realized I couldn't control my using. It sounds like a paradox or something, but when I realized that I couldn't control it, then I was ready to do something about it. I realized my life was just totally unmanageable. I couldn't control it, and the alcohol played the biggest role in that than anything else. And when I realized that, then I realized I could go for help, and I got to the point where I didn't want to go back to where I was in the streets, and I was willing to get help, and I was willing to do something about the condition I was in. And I, like today, this is something I often hold on to, not to using. I just look back how it was, and I don't want to be there. And one drink can lead me back there. One joint can lead me back.
Tell me, Tim, what do your friends and your family think of your recovery?
I tell you, my family thinks it's a miracle, and it just like a miracle, because there's no way it could happen without these programs and without the things I've come across. And that they just, a lot of people just can't believe it. They go, you don't use anymore? And they look at me, you know, because I was always a big user, constantly, all the time. And,
then you feel you will never drink again.
You know, I have no assurances, but I believe today if I keep doing what I have been and keep living by what I've learned from the programs that I do work and doing the things I do, I don't have to go back.
My name's Sally. I'm an addict, alcoholic, and I started when I was 12.
How old are you now?
21.
So you've had the problem then from age 12 to basically age 20.
Yes.
At 12 years of age, how did you get into the problem of alcoholism?
My mother is a hopeless alcoholic, and she gave me my first drink.
So you obtained it right there in the house?
Mm-hmm.
Did she do it deliberately, or did she just let you have access to it?
She needed a drinking buddy, and I was the only one around at the time, and it was either I drank or else I got out.
So then your only purpose for drinking was to get smashed?
Yeah, at the time.
Did you con yourself about some of the excessive drinking?
Oh, I conned myself all the time. I told myself that I was normal and that I was just drinking. You know, it was okay. It was for fun. You know, everybody drinks like this. You know, everybody drinks 2 bottles of vodka or so, you know. It's normal. It's okay for me.
Can you give us some case histories of some of the problems that then began to make you realize that, hey, this is no good. I've got to get out of this.
Well, I couldn't cope at all with work. It was like, it was even worse when I was in school. I couldn't get up to go to school. There was no way possible, because I had such a hangover in the morning that I couldn't possibly get up to go to school. And I started getting really, at first when I started drinking, I could just drink a little bit and be completely gone. And then after I started really getting into it, I had to drink more and more and use more and more before I would get the full effect.
When is it that you began to realize that, hey, I'm an alcoholic?
Well, it was just a few months ago that I couldn't handle my life anymore. I couldn't manage it. I couldn't manage going to work. I just couldn't cope with myself, my feelings. I couldn't live in the now. I lived mostly, you know, in the past, and the past was my only excuse to drink.
Is the dependence on alcohol much the same as the dependence upon drugs?
Yes, I think so.
The factors that would lead a person to become alcoholic are basically the same.
Mm-hmm.
Can you relate some of your history with the drug scene?
Yeah, I had started using heroin because my husband was using it. I found out later that after I had a little boy that I couldn't take care of him, I couldn't take care of myself, and I couldn't take care of my husband. And I felt like I was a failure as a wife, as a mother, as just a person altogether. I felt that, and that made me drink more. That was my whole escape. I could drink more and more, and the more I drank or the more I used, I thought more about, I'm a failure, I'll never be anything, so why don't I just become a real drunk, and then I won't have to worry about being anything.
Let's look at the transition again from the point when a person decides that I'm an alcoholic, I don't like my life, I need some help. What incentive is it that makes that person reach out and say, I need some help?
It's where they feel that you get to a certain point in your addiction to anything where you finally realize that you're just totally hopeless. You know, you feel that to yourself, which is not true. And you think, if I can't do something about this now, then I'm never going to be able to do it. And a lot of times there will be a great trauma in someone's life that will shake them up enough, like losing a husband or losing a son, or just losing a parent or losing the love of a parent, that'll make you think, wow, I've got to do this now or else I'm never going to be able to do it.
How big a factor is it in having people that are concerned about your welfare? How do friends fit into recovery?
It's the most fantastic thing in my life, because I've never really had anybody that cared about me, and now there's hundreds and hundreds of people that are backing me up and telling me that it's all going to get better. And it's the strangest feeling in the world to know that you're really loved for yourself, not because you've got more acid than somebody else or because you roll the best joints or you have the best martinis, you know. You're really loved for yourself, for the person that you are.
What would you say to a parent who says, well, my kid, I think he's got an alcohol problem, I can help him solve it?
I'd say don't try to do it alone, because you're only hurting him and yourself. You can't do it alone. You've got to have a lot of people behind you. Not necessarily a lot, but being alone is the worst part about... The nights are the worst part when you're coming down. It's a lonely time. It's depressing. You wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning where you would normally reach for a drink or normally reach for some kind of chemical. There's suddenly nothing there, and the only thing that you can do is get on that phone and call people for help. Say, you know, you don't even have to necessarily say, you know, I'm in trouble. It's just knowing that there's somebody there that you can talk to that makes you, they care, you know, enough to answer their phone at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, is everything all right?
Sally, will you ever drink again?
I can't say that. Being an addict and an alcoholic, I have to live for the minute, 60 seconds at a time. I hope not. I sincerely pray to God that I don't. But you can never really tell. And I'm just one that has to say that I have to live by the minute. And that's all I can do.
What then is your advice to someone who might suspect that they've got an alcoholism problem?
Don't let it sit and rot inside of you. Get it out. Go out and find help. I can't tell anybody at all how to run their lives, but I can kind of give them a little detail on what happened in mine and hope that maybe if they're listening hard enough, they might see that it could happen to them.
This current broadcast featuring the problems of teenage addiction will return right after this message.
As an extension of the World Tomorrow program, a booklet entitled Alcoholism is offered.
If you really want to help someone with a drinking problem, you can. But some do's and don'ts need to be considered. This booklet points out, do learn about the illness. What most people know is often misconception. Do discuss it with someone you can trust. Do approach the issue calmly. Don't punish, threaten, bribe, preach, or play the martyr. Don't cover up for, argue with, or drink along with the problem drinker. But most of all, don't ignore the problem. You can help by first examining the many causes and solutions outlined in the booklet, Alcoholism. With understanding, your concern can help someone win his or her battle with the bottle. Here's one way to start. Request the free booklet, Alcoholism. Send your request to Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. That's Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 44, Vancouver, B.C.
My name's Bob. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I'm 19 years old. I started using drugs and alcohol about 12 years old.
Can you give us some idea of what it was that attracted you to alcohol?
I was in search of that older brother. I'd never had an older brother, and I admired older kids. And they were into using drugs and alcohol. And when I did start using it, it was that relief from society that I needed.
Is drinking somehow a part of the average teenager's life?
Yes, I think so.
They do have access then to liquor?
Yes.
And what was your access at that early age to liquor?
Those older people that I did know. When I turned 16 and 17, I was able to buy liquor myself. I looked a little older than I was.
How did your drinking differ from that of your friends?
Well, I did not drink just to be social. I drank to get drunk because that's what I thought you were supposed to do.
And can you tell me some of the feelings? What were the feelings that drove you into problem drinking?
I couldn't handle facing reality. A lot of family problems. Father always gone. Couldn't communicate in school. I wasn't interested in all the things the kids in school were interested in. I wasn't just able to communicate.
Did you suspect that the problems were related to alcohol, or did you blame other people and other circumstances?
I blamed other people, places, and things.
Then what is it that helped you make the realization that it was actually an alcohol problem as opposed to other people and circumstances?
Well, when I was in my later years of 18, I was going to court for quite a few charges, and they sentenced me to a drug recovery house, and they used various programs in that drug recovery house and I heard other alcoholics who no longer drink talk, and I identified with them.
Bob, what advice would you have for other kids who find that they're getting into some of these same difficulties?
I think that if there is a young person out there that might think that he has a problem or she has a problem, that really you should try and get a hold of the Alcoholism Council or somebody through the Alcoholism Council and just talk to them, because we've all been there. I could say.
My name is Dee Dee. I'm 15 and I'm an alcoholic, and I started drinking when I was 12. I wouldn't call it socially. I always drank to get drunk, but I drank for peer pressure to be in the group.
Dee Dee, how available is liquor to young people?
Oh, God, you can get it anywhere. You stand in the corner and, you know, ask somebody to score it for you, or walk in and buy it. I could walk into a bar then. Like Bob said, it's easy to get. Anybody can get it. You take, steal it from your parents' cabinet.
Did you worry about your drinking?
Not until the last 6 months, really. I never really had a good time. You know, it always ended up, I was either puking or I would black out, which is a loss of memory, and end up in a place where I really didn't want to be or didn't know where I was. When it really got bad, when I moved out of, you know, my parents had split up and I moved away from home to live with my father, it was pretty bad. It was the last 6 months of my drinking, and nothing ever went right. I was just totally kind of freaked out. And then I started worrying about it.
What was it then, Dee Dee, that made you realize you were an alcoholic?
I answered 20 questions. It's a 20 questions. It's a little slip of paper where you can, you know, depending on how many yeses you get, like do you have blackouts or do you drink in the morning or do you drink alone? Questions like that, I answered 18. And that hit me like a rock, plus the fact of being sober for a whole day and looking back at my past from start to finish. And I just kind of broke down and I had to realize that I did have a problem. And at first I took it as like, my God, I've been punished, you know. The so-called God has punished me. He's made me an alcoholic, you know, and this is disgusting. And now I take it as I really am glad, because there's other kids, you know, that think, that I know a lot of kids with problems, and they keep saying, an alcoholic, and they shy away from me, or you are one, but I'm not. I couldn't be. You know, that's too low for me. You know, but it really is a disease, and people look at it as like Skid Row bums. You know, they put it down when it's really something like cancer, you know.
Because of the supposed novelty, I guess, of teenagers being an alcoholic, is it harder for a young person to gain recovery than for an adult?
Oh, I wouldn't think so. I think that the young people con themselves like I did for a long time and say, I'm too young, you know. I'm only 15, you know. I've got a whole life to drink, all that romantic drinking, you know, so-called, quote, right? And it wasn't romantic drinking. It was, you know, sheer hell. All I did was fight it, you know. I was always constantly fighting myself. Like Bob said, there's two different people in me. One wants to go straight and the other wants to get loaded. And I think that it's that one little factor is the only thing that separates the teenage alcoholic from the older alcoholic.
What is it that's the hardest part about recovery from alcoholism?
Staying sober. That I think that, like Bob said, it's a daily thing, you know. You've got to work on it. Sometimes it's even a minute thing. Am I or am I not, you know? For me, when I got here, I think it depended, you know, I can't say I was dying as a chronic alcoholic, but I was dead inside. When I finally got sober, I had no emotions at all, except for maybe anger and self-pity. And I figure that the hardest part is just staying sober. Sure, you go through I went through 2 weeks of shakes and withdrawals and feeling kind of sick inside and scared and lonely, you know, but I had people to back me up. I had hundreds of people to back me up and say, it's going to be all right. As soon as you go through this part, then the next step is just learning how to live sober, you know, learning how to live in reality instead of always in the make-believe.
Do you think it's an important factor for a reformed alcoholic to get involved in helping other people overcome their problems?
Oh, yeah. It's like I can't keep what I've got or what I've been given unless I give it away, which sounds kind of, you know, crazy. But I think that today, I don't know, I'm in a really good mood right now. Giving part of myself, like now I'm working with children. I want to start working with autistic and maybe mental retarded kids, or rehabbing other teenage alcoholics, you know, counseling. And I think that being an alcoholic and coming from where they came from, you know, off the streets, what we call it, you know, and from their past, I can share with them and help them to open up and then help them to throw the past away and help them find what they've got today. Otherwise, I don't think I'd even be sober if it wasn't for talking and working with other people.
Dee Dee, will you ever drink again?
As of right now, no. I hope not. I don't plan on it. I don't even if I could. See, the thing of the alcoholic is you can never just have one drink, because the one leads to another, and pretty soon you're lying on the floor, you know. And it's like I wouldn't even want to drink sociably today, you know. It's like I'm having so much fun living, just total living and doing things, going places, meeting people, helping people that are sick, and working with children. And I would never, you know, even want to. There comes a time when sometimes I feel like I need it, and then I call another alcoholic, and they help me out.
Any statement you'd like to make before a nationwide audience, just to reach out and try to help people?
Well, all right. I'd like to say that it is a disease, and that it cannot be quote, cured. You know, tomorrow I cannot walk out on the streets and have one drink without having another. But I can learn how to live, you know, today instead of having to go have a drink. This is going to sound funny. Only 3% of the alcoholics are on Skid Row, and that really blew my mind because I thought they were all down there. Nobody'd be up in, you know, Northridge, an alcoholic, or Beverly Hills, you know. And we found now that that's where most of the alcoholics are. And I think that it's not degrading. I mean, it's like walking into your doctor and saying, I've got cancer, you know. And it's the same thing. It is a disease, and it is serious. A lot of people are dying of it. My grandfather died of it. And I don't think that's much of a way to go as far as I'm concerned. That's about all.
These four case histories illustrate most of the major causal factors: weak or broken homes, peer pressure, misunderstanding over the use of alcohol, lack of direction in life, dominant roles in the creation of a teenage alcoholic. And I'm announcing, by the way, for the very first time, actually the second time in this three-part series, a brand new booklet right off the presses, yours by asking for it. The operators are waiting to take your call right now, called Alcoholism, A Worldwide Curse. It talks about alcohol in the brain, teenage tippling, health, how it can be ruined by alcoholism. It talks about people who drink too much, what to do and what not to do, in case you know someone like that, how driving and drinking don't mix, and talks about the family that drinks together, emphasizing what certain people in Italy and France and other areas do and what ethnic groups do in the United States. It does talk, too, about what to do about it, therapy and preventive therapy in overcoming the alcohol problem. That booklet, very concise and very thorough, is yours by return mail, absolutely free of charge, if you'll write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. That's Garner Ted Armstrong, Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. While you're at it, I hope you'll request the current number of The Plain Truth, coming up in March 1976. The cover is on the elections in the election year of our bicentennial, 76. And does it make any difference? Quite an article on all of the many presidential hopefuls and candidates in the upcoming number of The Plain Truth. In news articles, you will see major shifts in international relations occurring right now, how Japan and China are forging closer links and what that might mean to our future, how Turkey bolsters ties with the Soviet Union. You'll read, too, the Tindemans report. I was able to interview Prime Minister of Belgium, Leo Tindemans, when I visited the Benelux countries during the NATO summit conference and had a personal interview with Leo Tindemans. Well, he was also gleaning a report to be presented to the entire EEC Commission on full European unity, a revealing report to the European Council by Belgium's Prime Minister in that number of The Plain Truth, and also the tragic demise of Lebanon. In the human survival section of The Plain Truth for March 76, the article, Will Changing Weather Bring Mass Famines? The article on the return of the Dust Bowl, Technology's Toll, How Man's Activities Are Affecting Our Weather? The article on the Browning of the Green Revolution. And in my Speaks Out column, I talk about America's two choices. In our Orchids and Onions section, you will read how our readers respond to The Plain Truth and the broadcast, and of course, the radio and television log. All of this in The Plain Truth, absolutely free of charge, no price. You can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. That's Garner Ted Armstrong, Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. Now, the next broadcast in this series will conclude this three-part special on the curse of alcoholism. Next time, we'll take a look on what can and should be done and how to spot the alcoholic and where to turn for help. I hope you've enjoyed the two programs you've heard. Be sure to tune in for the third in this three-part series on a special series of broadcasts on alcoholism, and write for that brand new booklet advertised for the first time in this series right off the press on Alcoholism, A Worldwide Curse. The address again in just a moment. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. Listeners in the U.S., write to Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, write Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. The World Tomorrow is heard daily on Cheer Radio at 5:30 a.m. and 6:30 p.m.
What power there is in a word. A word can encourage, it can deceive, it can distort the truth. Someone has said, kind words are the music of the world. They can inspire and awaken courage, faith, and hope within us. St. Francis.